From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, actress Jodie Foster. She's won 2 Oscars and was nominated for 2 more. She'll tell us about entering the business at the age of 3 as TV's Coppertone Girl and going on to make such films as Taxi Driver, The Silence of the Lambs, The Accused, The Panic Room, and her new movie, The Dangerous Lives of Altar Boys, which she also co-produced. Also, rock historian Ed Ward tells the story of Frisco Records, a New Orleans soul label run by a female fry cook. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. A U.S. Forest Service employee has been jailed in Colorado for starting the fire that has burned more than 100,000 acres near Denver. A magistrate ordered Terry Barton held without bail until another hearing on Thursday. Federal officials say Barton admitted that she accidentally started the fire when she burned a letter from her estranged husband in an abandoned campground. Federal investigators say they confronted her after she made inconsistent statements about discovering the fire. A U.S. attorney in Denver said Barton should not be released on bail because she faces hostility in the community for having allegedly started the fire that has destroyed at least 25 homes. The Supreme Court has ruled that missionaries, politicians, and other solicitors need not get permission from local authorities before going door to door. The court struck down a local law in Stratton, Ohio, meant to protect elderly residents from being bothered at home. Bill Cohen reports from Ohio Public Radio.
4 years ago, Stratton passed a law requiring all door-to-door solicitors to register with the town and wear name tags. The idea was to protect senior citizens from being bothered. But Jehovah's Witnesses challenged the law, and on a vote of 8-1, the Supreme Court justices say they're right. Ray Vasvari is a lawyer for the ACLU, which sided with the Jehovah's Witnesses.
When we weigh convenience against fundamental rights, sometimes convenience has to take a back seat. If senior citizens don't want to be bothered by door-to-door solicitors, there are other ways to go about that. Courts have upheld hanging no soliciting signs. You can just close the door.
In the majority ruling, Justice John Paul Stevens hints if the law had covered only door-to-door salesmen, it might be okay. For NPR News, I'm Bill Cohen in Columbus.
Israeli soldiers shot and killed a Palestinian militant today as he drove his car through a village near Bethlehem. Palestinian officials are condemning the killing as an assassination. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
Israeli military sources said Walid Sabeh of the Al-Aqsa Martyr Brigades had carried out shooting attacks against Israeli soldiers and had recently recruited suicide bombers. The military sources said Israel recently arrested 2 Palestinians who admitted to planning a suicide attack and said they were recruited by the 30-year-old Sabeh. Palestinian witnesses said he was shot by soldiers who were 200 yards from the village of Al-Khadr near Bethlehem as he drove his car down the village's main street. Israel Radio said Israeli snipers from an undercover unit had shot the Palestinian. Meanwhile, Israeli police and soldiers, backed by helicopters, searched for a Palestinian they said had infiltrated into Jerusalem and was planning a suicide attack. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
In stocks today, the Nasdaq gained 48 points, more than 3%, to close at 1553. The Dow Industrials gained 213 points. This is NPR News. A federal judge has refused to dismiss the indictment against John Walker Lynn, the man accused of conspiring with the Taliban to kill Americans in Afghanistan. Lynn's attorney said the 21-year-old Californian had a constitutional right to aid the Taliban against their Afghan rivals and that he never harmed or intended to harm Americans. In all, the judge denied 7 motions by Lynn's legal team. In soccer's World Cup, the U.S. team upset Mexico by 2-0 today. The victory puts the Americans in the quarterfinals for the first time since 1930. Kayvon Antonio Hedari has more from South Korea.
The United States continued its successful run in the 2002 World Cup by beating its most bitter rival, Mexico. And coach Bruce Arena hopes that the performance of a U.S. team that last reached the quarterfinals of the tournament, the first time it was ever staged in 1930, will ignite enthusiasm at home.
And somebody say to me after the game on the television, we were lucky. We are lucky. Well, look at the teams we played. played and beaten, and the results we've gotten. We're not lucky. We beat a Mexican team that's been outstanding in this World Cup.
The players received a phone call from President Bush before the game and then rode goals by Brian McBride and Landon Donovan to clinch the 2-0 win. The U.S. will meet Germany on Friday. For NPR News, I'm Kevon Antonio Haidari in Jeonju.
A California judge has thrown out a second-degree murder conviction against Marjorie Knoller, the San Francisco lawyer whose dogs mauled a neighbor to death. The judge sentenced Knoller's husband, Robert Noel, to the maximum sentence for involuntary manslaughter, 4 years in prison. Knoller is scheduled for sentencing on the same charge next month. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Keen, helping clients manage business performance through business consulting, application development and integration, and application outsourcing. Keen, we get IT done.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Jodie Foster, has been in the public eye ever since the age of 3, when she was the Coppertone girl on TV commercials. She made Disney movies as a child, but at the age of 12 and a half, she took the bold move of playing a child prostitute in the now classic film Taxi Driver. She went on to an acclaimed career as an adult. She's won 2 Best Actress Oscars for her role in Silence of the Lambs as an FBI agent and her role in The Accused as a rape victim. Earlier this year, Jodie Foster starred in the popular thriller The Panic Room. Now she's starring in the new movie The Dangerous Lives of Altar Boys. The film is about 2 rebellious boys who attend a strict Catholic high school. They're collaborating on an action comic book in which they create a fantasy version of their lives, with their strict teacher, Sister Assumpta, as the motorcycle-riding villain. Sister Assumpta is played by Jodie Foster. In this scene, after the boys have stolen a statue of St. Agatha from the school, they're questioned by Sister Assumpta and Father Casey, played by Vincent D'Onofrio.
Do you know anything about this?
No, sister.
Mr. Sullivan?
I've never seen that before.
Mr. Doyle? Frankly, this kind of crudity isn't really your style.
No, sister.
Francis, do you know anything about our Saint Agatha?
Yes, Father.
Good. Tell us what you know.
She was really good looking, and she promised God she'd be a virgin, but then some guy wanted to marry her, and when she wouldn't, he stuck her in her brothel.
Stop it!
And then he cut her breasts off.
I won't tolerate any more disrespect from you. Now, you confess. You tell us why you did this.
Actually, I heard that he branded her before he...
You hold your tongue, young man. You are on a terrible downward spiral. He sees in your heart. He knows what you do. I fear for you.
Jodie Foster, welcome to Fresh Air. Now, you play a nun in The Dangerous Lives of Altar Boys. Were you around nuns at all when you were growing up? In church or in school? I'm not even sure you went to school.
I went to school, all right.
Did you? I thought you might have had private tutors.
No. I went to a very strict French school, actually, where everything was in French. So it was not a Catholic school, and I've been exposed to no religion whatsoever. I'm probably one of the few people that was raised as a true atheist, which, of course, makes me terribly interested in everything religious.
So your mother was an atheist?
No, my mom actually was an ex-Catholic. She actually had gone to high school in a convent and came from a Catholic family, and I suppose that probably sparked some interest with me.
So why a French school?
You know, that's a good question to ask her. She had very strong ideas that religion should have no place in education, and she started looking around and had fantasies about, you know, living in a French chateau or traveling. She'd never been anywhere, and she put me in this French school, and I guess I have kind of an ear for languages. I learned, I spoke fluently within a year.
Now, your character in the movie, the nun, thinks that the comic book fantasies that these teenage boys are reading and also writing, particularly the comic book violence in these fantasies, is very damaging. So, go ahead.
Yeah, I think Sister Sumter's motivations, she is a villain, of course, I have to say that, but a villain that we all understand, I think that we can all see in ourselves. She's concerned for their safety. She's worried that in some ways they're on a downward spiral and that they're spiraling out not just spiritually but also physically and emotionally. And her way of trying to help them and trying to save them is trying to put an even stronger thumb of authority on them, trying to kind of squash their egos and squash their self-image. And, of course, we all know that that doesn't work very well.
Yeah, so she means well, but she cuts off an important part, or tries to cut off an important part of their fantasy lives because she doesn't really understand it.
Yeah, and now, as very often happens with you know, religious education, you're all these 14-year-olds are being taught by people who have never had children and don't really have a strong or a deep understanding of children. But even though they do want to do good works, they don't necessarily have the equipment that they need in order to understand their vocabulary.
Now, I'm thinking, here you are playing this nun who confiscates comic books because she finds the fantasy so disturbing. And at the age of 12 and a half, you were starring in Taxi Driver.
Yes, I was. Yes, I was. I was a child actor.
So you were immersed in, or at least occasionally immersed in, the type of fiction that some people would find dangerous to expose young people to.
Right. Yeah, that's true. I suppose some people would, and maybe to some young people it is. I don't know. In my case, I think I've always felt that more information is better, as long as children know how to handle it emotionally.
When you were 12 and a half and got the part in Taxi Driver, was your mother afraid of what you'd be exposed to playing a child prostitute?
Well, you know, first of all, I had been an actor since I was 3 years old, so I had a long body of experience. And my mom really took me to all sorts of movies and took me to R-rated movies whenever she could. And, you know, we talked a lot about politics and we talked about deeper things. And I grew up in Hollywood, so I was exposed to it all over the place. I knew the work of Martin Scorsese and knew what an artist he was and had seen Mean Streets and had also done Alice Doesn't Live Here Anymore with him. So I don't really think it was that big of a consideration. It was a consideration, for example, for the Board of Education. And at that time, they weren't, you know, they really wanted to know that I would not be emotionally damaged by playing this part. So they brought in my lawyers brought in a psychologist to decipher after an hour of meeting me, to decipher whether I would be, you know, entirely damaged by my atmosphere.
Well, how the heck did they figure that out? I mean, what did they do to test your psychological health?
They asked me a lot of questions like, do you like Chinese food? You know, things like that. I have a very fond memory of my therapy session at 12, and it really was pretty boring.
Let me just play a scene from this film.
Okay.
In this film, you know, Travis Bickle, played by Robert De Niro, wants to rescue you from a life of prostitution. He's just kind of taking you as a cause. You know, you're a 12-and-a-half-year-old kid or a 13-year-old kid who's being sold by a pimp, played by Harvey Keitel. And so De Niro goes to Keitel and buys some time with you, not to have sex with you, but to convince you to let him rescue you from this life. So here you are in a room together for the first time. He wants to change your life. You want to give him his money's worth because he just bought some time with you. Let's hear an excerpt of that scene.
What's your name?
Easy.
Well, that's not any kind of name.
Well, that's easy to remember.
Yeah, but what's your real name?
I don't like my real name.
Well, what's your real name?
Iris.
Well, what's wrong with that? That's a nice name.
That's what you think.
Now, don't do that. Don't do that. Don't you remember me? You mean, remember when you got into a taxi? It was a checkered taxi. You got in and that guy Matthew came by and he said he wanted to take you away? He pulled you away?
I don't remember that.
You don't remember any of that?
No.
Well, that's all right. I'm going to get you out of here.
So we better make it, or Sport will get mad. So how do you want to make it?
I don't want to make it. Who's Sport?
Oh, that's Matthew. I call him Sport. Want to make it like this?
Listen, can I understand something? But you're the one that came into my cab. You're the one that wanted to get out of here.
Well, I must have been stoned.
Why? What do you mean? They drug you?
Oh, come off it, man.
What are you doing?
Don't you want to make it?
No, I don't want to make it. I want to help you.
Well, I can help you.
At the end of this scene, Jodie Foster, you're unzipping De Niro's fly.
Mm-hmm.
Were you old enough yet to get what this was about?
Yes, yeah, and 12-year-olds are, and I think we're all very foolish and blind to think that they don't. You know, I lived in L.A. I lived in an urban place, and I had seen a lot of movies, and you know, I had long talks with my mom, and sort of the way I approached my character was this was a runaway and somebody who probably was taking a lot of drugs and who'd really been under the influence of an older man, and somebody who would run away from a kind of an oppressive family structure. Boy, I understood all that. And, you know, I went to a private school where I wore a little gray skirt and I got straight A's and spoke different languages. And I mean, I don't think I'm scarred.
I was going to ask you.
You never know, yeah, but I don't think I'm scarred.
I was going to ask you if you felt you walked away with any scars. Guess not.
Well, no. And in fact, I think in some ways it's good to, if you know your child and if you know your child is ready for having these kinds of discussion, it's good in some ways to show them the adult world when they're still open to having conversations about you know, meaningful paths and what makes an unmeaningful life and things like that. And in some ways, sometimes younger, if it's a slightly younger than adolescence, it's almost better.
Taxi Driver is such an extraordinary movie. I mean, it's at the top of, or near the top of so many people's lists, and so many of us have seen it, you know, over and over again. I'm thinking, you know, at the age of 12 and a half, to work with Scorsese and De Niro and Keitel, you know, gee.
It really changed my life. At that time, I had made many more movies than either one of them had, but...
oh, God, that's so amazing.
But I had played mostly, you know, people used to ask of me, you know, act naturally, be yourself, say that line just as you would say that line. And I just never occurred to me that being an actor was ever going to be some kind of a satisfying career, because it just seemed dumb to me. You just, you know, read the lines someone else wrote, and there wasn't a lot of thought into it, and there was no building of a character. And it really wasn't until I met Robert De Niro and he kind of took me under his wing and sat down with me for hours at a time that I really understood that there was more to acting than just being a puppet.
If you remembered, I'd love to hear some of the things he told you in those talks about acting.
Well, I wish that he had some kind of, wonderful, miraculous things to say to me. Mostly he would take me to these little divey coffee shops in different parts of town, sometimes in Spanish Harlem and different parts of town that he found. And he didn't talk to me much. He just let me sit there. And after a while, I realized that this was his, you know, he was going to do this again, you know, for another hour. So I just looked around. I'd talk with other people, and I'd go on my merry way and, you know, read the newspaper occasionally. And after a while, he might bring in the script, and we'd start working on the script, and he'd do the lines over and over and over again. And having been a child actor, of course, I knew my lines. So now I was really bored because I'd have to do these lines over and over again with this adult. And then by the end of our meetings, he would throw improvisation in. And that was, I think, a really good lesson, because I suddenly learned that improvisation was about knowing the text so well that you could deviate from it in a meaningful way, as if you were had been living this conversation, and always find your way back to the text. And I think that's a lesson that most young actors don't really get.
Do you think that he took you to divey coffee shops, as you described them, because he thought maybe you'd see characters like the character you were playing?
You know, I think it was just his way of getting me to feel comfortable with him, and I don't think he really knew what he had in mind. At that, you know, Robert De Niro then and Robert De Niro now are two very different guys.
Mm-hmm.
Then he was a guy who made one film every 2 years or 3 years. He immersed himself in the character. He barely ever slept when he was doing Taxi Driver. He was a mess. I mean, he was living the character of Travis Bickle. And so his method in some ways was just to live in that place and to try and drag me into it. You know, I'd made a lot of movies. I'd done a lot of TV shows. I did a lot of rolling of my eyes and thinking, well, this is a big waste of time. But I think by the end of it, I really realized how important it was and how it had changed my characterization.
Did Martin Scorsese give you any advice about your character or about working with the actors in the film?
Well, he brought in a girl that he had met that had similar circumstances. You know, a very thin, very young girl who had some of the mannerisms that he wanted me to copy, and he kind of pointed them out to me. And that's pretty much all he did. And then he did a lot of takes at that time. He shot a lot of film and did a lot of takes. And I remember the one thing that I remember about him that I think is the most inspiring to me as a director is that he used to sit behind the camera, of course, back then when there were no video monitors that directors could hide behind. He'd sit behind the camera, and sometimes we'd do, I don't know, 30 takes, 40 takes, but every take he would laugh. He would giggle and have to hold his mouth shut so that he wouldn't make noise. And not just the first or the second take, but every take, he was actually enjoyed the performances so much that it was almost as if he was inside the actors' faces.
My guest is Jodie Foster. She produced and co-stars in the new movie The Dangerous Lives of Altar Boys. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jodie Foster. When we left off, we were talking about her role as a child prostitute in Taxi Driver. Shortly after that, she made the Disney film Freaky Friday. I'm almost shocked that the Disney productions, the Disney studio, cast you in Freaky Friday, even though you had much more of a history with children's movies. After Taxi Driver, I can't believe that,
I'm so
that they
happy
wanted
that
you
they
in a
did.
Disney film, you know, because yeah, go ahead.
And that tells you how loyal Disney was, mm-hmm. you know, because I had made many movies for Disney before them. And mm-hmm. It was a conscious choice by my mom when she was ferreting out which film I would do next. She really wanted to make sure that I would go back and forth and do different kinds of movies and so that people wouldn't pigeonhole me as one type of character. And she felt that it was very important for me to go back and in some ways do a teen film or Disney film. And at that time, you know, Freaky Friday was probably the first feminist movie out there for youngsters.
In Freaky Friday, you're quite the tomboy. You play hockey. You're also wearing braces. could you relate to this character? Was this character, like, foreign to you outside of movies? Because he's like this suburban tomboy schoolgirl. And it just seems like a life that was probably as far away as the life of Iris in Taxi Driver.
Well, not really. I mean, I went to school and I didn't wear braces, but I certainly played a lot of sports and I was kind of a tomboy. So mm-hmm. I don't think it was as big a stretch as you might think. I mean, I think my mom really went out of the way to make sure that I could lead as normal a life as possible. And because you have to remember that I had been in the business since I was 3 years old. So that was something I had to fight for. Normalcy, feeling normal, feeling like I fit in was something I really had to fight for.
You got your break into the business, as they say, when you were three. You were the Coppertone kid on TV commercials. It was the TV commercials and not the still photographs. Am I right about that?
That's right. The still photographs came out in the 50s, but I was the first commercial that they did with a Coppertone girl in the 60s.
So was your behind showing on the commercials like in the still photographs?
You know, they tried to get that dog to pull down my pants, but he just wouldn't do it. So instead, as you'll see from the commercial, I stand in front of the billboard where you see the billboard of the Coppertone girl, and the dog just keeps barking and barking at my pants, but he can't quite make it to my underwear.
And for anyone who doesn't know, Coppertone is a suntan lotion that was particularly popular in the 50s and 60s. So how did you get cast in this?
My brother was an actor, and he went in to do an interview, and my mom didn't want to leave me in the car because it was a bad neighborhood. And, of course, in those days, you did leave your children in the car quite a bit. So she said, come on in, and I loved my brother and followed him around and wouldn't leave him, and when the people asked him questions, I volunteered my name, and I started flexing my muscles and running around, and they changed the campaign and decided not to hire a little boy to be in the Coppertone commercial and to actually say, well, let's go find a little Coppertone girl, and this girl will be it. So that was my first commercial.
Was your mother already connected in Hollywood?
My mom had been a publicist with a very famous publicist, so she knew a little bit about the business. But, you know, she didn't really have any kind of agenda about us entering into it. My brother really begged and begged and begged to become an actor like every other kid on his block. And finally, it took her a couple of years. She finally said, well, if you want to go on an interview, then you can. And then eventually we both got into it.
Did you want to do it as badly as he wanted to act?
I don't ever remember wanting to be an actor, but then I don't remember a lot at 3 years old. I really don't. And it's something, I don't ever remember not being an actor. It's just something I've always done. And there have been times in my life where I've really questioned it because I just don't have that personality. I know actors very well, and, you know, they're the kind of people that like to jump on the table and put a lampshade on their head and do impressions and dance for grandma, and I just have never been like that. And in some ways, I think it has colored my performances. I do have a strange style as an actor that's not quite as external. That's a little more internal than most actors you'll meet.
So many kids who were child actors were damaged by their early acting experiences, damaged emotionally, and they feel like they've been cheated out of an essential part of their lives, or that they were literally cheated financially by their own family who squandered the money that they made. You seem to have survived intact and with a great career. I mean, that led to a great career in adulthood as well. What do you think prevented that damage from getting you?
Well, it is a difficult place to grow up in, and there are responsibilities and stresses put upon you that are really meant for adults, and yet you have to figure out how to live them in a child's body or in an adolescent's body. And there are things, there are dynamics that are unnatural. I mean, I don't think that it is natural for a parent to have a place in a child's career. You know, it's really important for a kid who's becoming passionate about something as an artist to kind of do it on their own and to rebel against their parents in some ways, and to not have their parents' approval somehow be a day in and day out be of any kind of day in and day out significance, and also you know, financially, the melting of your parents' assets and your assets, I think, it can be very damaging to young people. But you know, I have to say, I got through it, I guess. It just depends on your personality. Some people can handle it and some people can't. And I have to say, I feel really enriched by the experience of being able to travel and learn different languages and talking to adults on an equal basis at a young age, having adult responsibilities and living up to them. I'm really pleased that this is how I grew up.
Jodie Foster will be back in the second half of the show. She co-produced and co-stars in the new film, The Dangerous Lives of Altar Boys. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by DMZ Columbia Records and bluegrass musician Ralph Stanley, featuring his new self-titled album produced by T-Bone Burnett. Available in stores. Information online at ralphstanley.net. And the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward profiles a small New Orleans soul label known as Frisco Records. Also, Jodie Foster reflects on making the transition from child actress to adult movie star. And we talk about her Academy Award-winning performances in Silence of the Lambs and The Accused. We'll be right back. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jodie Foster. Earlier this year, she starred in the thriller The Panic Room. Now she's co-starring in the new movie The Dangerous Lives of Altar Boys, which she also co-produced. She won Oscars for her performances in The Silence of the Lambs and The Accused. She's had an acting career since the age of 3. When you went to Yale, I remember it really made news. It was on TV, it was in the newspapers. And everybody was wondering, what's it going to be like for this young movie star to be a student at a university? In retrospect, was it possible for you to just be a student there? Or did you feel like you were sticking out all the time?
Well, it was a wonderful moment in my life. I'm so glad that I did that. And it was a big step to take. At that time, really no other young actors had ever done that, sort of left their careers and said, I'm going to get an education. But it was, had always been phenomenally important to me. And I just never knew I was going to be an actor when I grew up. In fact, it was the farthest thing from my mind. I thought, I'll act for a few years when I'm 16 or 17, and then that'll be it. No one will want me anymore, which is pretty much what everybody had told me would happen. Yes, I did think that I was somehow going to have this anonymity, and for the first time in my life, I actually felt that. I really felt like I was living without any kind of scrutiny, without the eyes of everybody on me. And unfortunately, my freshman year, assassination attempt on Ronald Reagan kind of shattered that, and very quickly I realized that that hadn't been true at all, and that people had been watching me all along. And then, of course, it became a mad media circus, and my life in college really kind of changed from then on. But then after that, I sort of moved off campus and had a new life in college, and things did die down somewhat. And it truly was the best time in my life. I don't know who I'd be if I hadn't been there.
Did you study acting when you were at Yale?
I studied no acting when I was at Yale. Not that I could have, because, you know, that's liberal arts education in their mind is really about... It's not a trade school. I didn't study any theater at all, although that was certainly available to me. I really wanted to learn about literature. That was my passion. I loved reading. I had always loved reading, and that was the place that I saw for myself. I really wanted to stay as far away from acting as I could, and even as far away from kind of the real world as I could. I'd been paying taxes since I was 3 years old, and I really wanted to be in an ivory tower for once.
What are some of the books that meant the most to you during your college years?
Oh, boy. I really discovered Afro-American literature when I was in college, and it just hit me. You know, I just read something one day and said, I love this, and I want to read more of things like this, and then just couldn't get enough. So Toni Morrison... Song of Solomon, I think, was my favorite book and still is, and was something that I thought a lot about and I ended up doing my senior essay on.
Huh. And do you think studying literature has helped you, for instance, in reading screenplays and evaluating them?
Oh, absolutely. Everything that you do as an actor is about reading. Everything you do as a director is about reading. It's about reading deeper and reading between the lines and perceiving more than just what's on the surface. And literature and the study of literature is all that. It's just about looking deeper.
As you mentioned, John Hinckley shot President Reagan during your freshman year. Can I ask you a couple of questions about that, or would you rather not go there?
Well, I'd kind of rather not. It'll end up just being me saying, I don't really talk about that.
Right, that's fine then.
I mean, you can ask him, but I'll just say, gosh, I don't really talk about that.
Since a lot of people said, he was probably inspired by Taxi Driver, therefore Taxi Driver must be a bad movie, and, we can't allow movies like that to be made again because they inspire killings. Did it ever test your faith in films or in a certain type of violent film that you think is a good film even though there's violence in it?
Well, I love dramas, and I believe in dramas, and I think that dramas are provocative and evocative, and they're the stuff that makes you think harder and deeper about who you are and about your role and sociopolitically. So I don't believe in censoring art, and so in that way, I do think that movies that attack issues like violence and attack them dramatically are important to have out there. But as I like to say, you can take a 2x4, and you can do two things. You can build a building, or you can hit somebody over the head with it. And it's really up to the person to make a decision about what they're going to do with that. I really try and hope and believe that it's my responsibility as an artist to make movies that help make people better and not worse. And I try my hardest, as sometimes mistargeted as it may be, I do try my hardest to make sure that my films reflect that hope in me. And so that hopefully it will inspire people to be better and not worse. But it's you just don't know what other people will do with that information.
One of your most popular films is Silence of the Lambs, in which you play an FBI agent on the trail of a serial killer. No problems with that film in terms of the violence in it, or just, I'm just wondering if it was like creepy for you to deal with that kind of material after the whole Huntley affair.
I love Silence of the Lambs, and I certainly I love the book, and it was something that I pursued actively. Because I did feel that the perspective in the movie, the point of view of the film, was from the point of view of a young person who believed that her destiny was to save people. And that is the point of view of the camera of that movie. A very different point of view than, of course, being the cannibal or the serial killer himself and looking at the world around him with those eyes on. I did feel that the film is defendable, that it is it has the right point of view. I think Silence is a wonderful film, and I really felt like it needed to be made. And there was a part of me that felt that was terribly drawn to it.
Mm-hmm.
I had played a lot of victims in my life, and you know, if you asked me at the time why I was playing victims, I would have said, "Well, you're crazy. What are you even talking about? I don't play victims." But when you look back on my work, you see a pattern. You see an unconscious pattern. Silence of the Lambs, in some ways, was the end of that pattern, because it was the first time that I played somebody whose destiny was to save them. Something that she knew as a small girl, something that she knew before she was born. There was a part of her that was drawn and who's destined to find those marginalized women out there, those women who were too fat, too thin, too small, too quiet, and to be their saviors.
Let me play a short scene from Silence of the Lambs. And you play an FBI agent who's trying to track down a serial killer, and as part of your search, you go visit Hannibal Lecter, who is the serial killer who killed and ate his victims. You're visiting him in prison where he's serving life, and you think he'll have clues about this serial killer you're trying to track down. Hannibal Lecter is played by Anthony Hopkins. This is your first meeting with him, in which you're trying to get information from him, and he's both testing you and playing with you at the same time.
Tell me, what did Miggs say to you? Multiple Miggs in the next cell. He hissed at you. What did he say?
He said, "I can smell your..."
I see. I myself cannot. You use Evian skin cream. And sometimes you wear lead at home. But not today.
Did you do all these drawings, Doctor?
Ah. That is the Duomo scene from the Belvedere. You know Florence?
All that detail just from memory, sir?
Memory, agents, darling, is what I have instead of a view.
Well, perhaps you'd care to lend us your view on this questionnaire, sir.
No. You were doing fine. You had been courteous and receptive to courtesy. You had established trust with the embarrassing truth about Miggs. And now this ham-handed segue into your questionnaire. It won't do.
I'm only asking you to look at this, Doctor. Either you will or you won't.
Jodie Foster, can you talk a little bit about working opposite Anthony Hopkins in these scenes with him?
Oh, he's such a wonderful actor and such a truly nice man, one of the great nice men out there. I was kind of scared to death of him. The only time that I'd met him was at a rehearsal, and we'd started, you know, rehearsing right away, you know, he brought that voice out, and I kind of got scared of him. And for some reason, during the shooting, we were always behind glass. You know, he was either behind glass or I was behind glass. So we never really got to hang out together at all. And I was kind of scared of him the whole movie. And then one day over tuna fish sandwiches at the end of the film, I admitted it to him, and finally he admitted to me, I was kind of scared of you too. And it was sort of a very funny moment. And from then on, I think we've become much more comfortable with each other.
Why was he scared of you?
I guess it was just probably the intensity of our characters playing opposite each other. You know, that dialogue in Silence of the Lambs is something that you could do in a play for the rest of your life. It's so rich and so intimate, and yet there's so much gamesmanship behind it as well. It's very rich stuff, and when you literally almost never see your partner except behind glass, it just creates this very strange atmosphere on set.
Now, you're using a Southern accent. I'm not sure exactly which state it's supposed to be from.
She's originally from West Virginia, but had been transplanted to Montana, so has lost her accent slightly.
Mm-hmm. So why was it felt that an accent was needed for the role?
That was a choice of the director, and also very much a big part of the novel. She's somebody who is from the South and is not from the Tony family that others in the FBI have come from. Mm-hmm. She has had to work hard her whole life to be anything more than ordinary. And she was, you know, orphaned at a young age and was thrust into living with people that didn't really want her. So it creates a character for Clarice, who's somebody who is very much like a lot of these victims that the killer has been killing. That's her background. She's a nobody from nowhere. And the accent, I think, is very important. It's a fuel to Hannibal Lecter, because he can glean parts of her past through her voice, things that she'd love to cover up. It's her weakness.
Any thoughts about your own voice? Is that something that you've worked on at all, or that directors worked on with you, or did it just kind of develop on its own?
No, nobody's ever worked on my voice. A lot of people made fun of me because I had a deep voice my whole life, but no one's ever worked on my voice. However, I have had a fantasy about doing radio, because I'm such a big NPR head and I can listen to radio every single day. And I think, wouldn't it be great? I could be wearing, you know, my pajamas. I could sound really important, but I'd be wearing my pajamas.
That's right. Unless you had to go to the studio every day, in which I don't think you'd want to be wearing your pajamas. My guest is Jodie Foster. She co-produced and co-stars in the new movie, The Dangerous Lives of Altar Boys. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Jodie Foster is my guest, and she's one of the producers and stars of the new movie, The Dangerous Lives of Altar Boys. Now, your recent movie, The Panic Room, you were pregnant during some of the shooting of that. I think you found out during the shoot that you were actually pregnant.
Very quickly into the shoot, I found out I was pregnant. So I was pregnant for the entire movie, pretty much.
So how pregnant were you by the time it was over?
I was so pregnant by the time it was over. It was crazy. David Fincher, who's just such a wonderful director, I'm so honored to work with him. I really, really respect him. But he also shoots really slow, and he's very meticulous, and he has very strong ideas about how he wants his movie to be done. So, you know, it was a long shoot. And it was also very physically demanding, kind of exhausting shoot. So by the end of it, I was completely spent.
Did you have any reservations about any of the scenes, knowing that you were pregnant? Was there any kind of action in it that you weren't that comfortable doing?
Yeah, and when I found out I was pregnant, I sat down and I said, let's look through everything, let's look through the schedule, and let's figure out the best way to do it. I know, having been pregnant before, I certainly knew how things go, or at least how they're supposed to go, and you know that in the first few months you can do this, and the next few months you can do that, and that you're a little more limited as time goes on. So there were certain things, of course, that I couldn't do. And luckily, I have a double, Jill Stokesbury, who looks so much like me that there are even some shots in the trailer that are her full face and nobody ever knows it's her.
How'd you find her?
You know, she when I was working on making a movie called Summersby, she showed up and said, everybody says I look like her and I'm a stunt person and I'd like to try and be a double for her. And she's worked with me ever since.
Wow. So she's always there to double for you.
Yeah, and she's a great lady, I enjoy her company. And it was some of the physical stuff was very difficult on this movie, especially since there were so many takes and it had to be done so many times. But there were things that I couldn't have even anticipated, like, you know, running upstairs. Well, that's not a big deal. It's not even necessarily a big deal when you're pregnant if you run upstairs once. But if you have to run upstairs 50 times and then run down them or walk down them 50 times in order to get to the place that you started in the first place, it can become very damaging, very difficult.
Was David Fincher okay with all of this?
Well, he was, because he has a daughter that he loves, that he's raising, and I think he could really empathize. So he was great with us.
I want to ask you about one other movie, The Accused, in which mm-hmm. you play somebody who is raped. I don't know if you're the kind of actress who does a lot of elaborate preparation before a role, or if you just, you know, kind of go and do mm-hmm. it. But
It depends.
I mean, it's certainly not the role you can prepare for.
You can't
prepare
for a role like that.
Right.
You really can't. I mean, if it was, you know, if you're playing Henry VIII, you kind of know that you got to go look through some books and do some stuff. But to play somebody who's in the wrong place at the wrong time, mm-hmm. There really isn't a lot of research to be done. I mean, there is the building of a character. You say she walks like this and she talks like this and these are the people that she knows and this is her education and her background. We can't forget that I was young when I made that movie, so I was doing a lot of unconscious denying. I remember specifically that I read the script literally once before I went to do the movie. And I think it was because partly I was scared, and I just didn't want to even think about what I had to do. So I just avoided it. And that kind of worked for me then.
But you wanted to take the role. You thought it was going to be a good movie, but you didn't want to have to spend too much time thinking about it. Is that it?
I wanted to take the role because it moved me, but I just didn't even want to think about how I was going to get there.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of typical, I think, of 25-year-olds, that you know you're drawn towards something and psychologically, but you don't really know why, and you don't even want to ask yourself the question. You just kind of dive head first. And, of course, had I been 40, maybe I wouldn't have taken that movie.
So did that put you in the position of doing more improvisatory reaction for the rape scene than you've improvised in other films? Are you usually like more studious about it?
Well, no, I wouldn't say there was much improvisation. With a scene like that, you really can't be improvised because you don't want to have to repeat it 50 times.
Right.
It's too painful for everyone, not just me, but for the boys, for the men playing the rapists. Mm-hmm. It was, of course, much harder on them than it was on me, typical. And I spent a lot of time kind of getting them through it. Because in some ways I had the self-righteous part, you know. I had the one who knew that she was on the correct side of the argument. And it was hard for them to play what they had to play. So I did not want them improvising because I just didn't want a lot of broken bones and a lot of pain.
Right.
So we did actually, in rehearsals, kind of go through studiously and figure out what it was going to be. But at the same time, nobody can really tell you what that moment's going to be like. And even though every inch of it was choreographed, through some of the scenes, I absolutely cannot remember what happened after they said action and between cut. I just don't remember. I remember before and I remember after, but I don't remember during.
What do you think, it's a little self-protective mechanism?
I do, and it is common with rape victims, which is interesting,
mm-hmm,
that they
mm-hmm.
They black out and they shut it out.
Can you watch your own films, and are some of your films easier for you to watch than others? I imagine watching the rape scene in The Accused is not like a great time for you.
Right. Well, I do watch the movies right after I've done them and through the process of cutting them and you know, the beginning of the previews and all that kind of stuff. And then once the movie's out, I never can watch them again. Occasionally, I'll catch one on, you know, pay-per-view or HBO or something, and I kind of cringe and have to turn it off. I just can't sit through it.
Can you explain why?
I don't know. I guess it's a moment that's passed, and you've lived it so much and so intensely, but you just don't want to go back there again. As part of you just doesn't want to go back there again, and you do feel self-conscious about it because you have seen it either so many times or you've lived it so many times, you've talked about it so many times. You just are not ready to live through it again.
What do you have coming up now, either that you're, you know, starring in, directing, producing?
Well, I don't have any plans right now. I purposely do that. I like to finish one movie and then not think about anything and then decide what I'm going to do next. But my heart is really in directing, I have to say. That's really my primary focus now. So I'm hoping to direct Flora Plum, which was a film that was about to go a year and a half ago. And unfortunately, 2 weeks before shooting, Russell Crowe had an accident, and we were shut down. It is a labor of love for me and something that I've loved for a long time, and it's going to be hard for me to get it off the ground again, but I will.
Okay, well, good luck with it. Jodie Foster, it's been a pleasure to have you here. Thank you so much for talking with us. Jodie Foster co-produced and co-stars in the new movie The Dangerous Lives of Altar Boys. Coming up, rock historian Ed Ward tells the story of a small New Orleans soul label. This is Fresh Air. During the heyday of independent record labels in this country, between 1948 and 1970, countless entrepreneurs tried to storm the charts with homegrown productions and artists with varying degrees of talent. Probably none had the cards stacked against her as much as Connie LaRocca of Frisco Records. Rock historian Ed Ward tells her story and the story of some lost masterpieces.
It's a tribute to the incredible brew of music in New Orleans that between 1962 and 1965, a fry cook in a Carrollton Avenue chicken shack could run a record label that recorded a batch of great soul music, even if most of it never got heard outside of the city. Connie LaRocca was not only a fry cook, but a woman, nearly unheard of in the record business. But as she worked at her brother-in-law's place, she listened to the radio and remembered her love of rock and roll, so she decided to start a label. Wisely, she went to Harold Adkins, a local DJ who knew everyone in town, and he offered to help. The label got off to a great start in September 1962. Mrs. LaRocca had gone to see Danny White, a local singer who packed out the clubs but didn't have a recording contract for some reason. She got him together with songwriter Al Reed, put Danny and his band into Cosmo Matassa's legendary studio, and the result was one of soul music's great lost classics.
Tomorrow was our wedding day, but with my own two eyes, today I saw you kissing my best friend. Now you can kiss tomorrow goodbye.
With a nice lazy horn section, Irving Bannister's itchy guitar, and Danny's impassioned vocal, Kiss Tomorrow Goodbye should have been a hit. In New Orleans, it was a hit, and sold well throughout the South, moving over 100,000 copies. Frisco's next stars were singing backup vocals on Kiss Tomorrow Goodbye. The Ruzanne sisters, Laura, Wanda, and Barbara, were high school students who sang in clubs under the watchful eye of their dad.
Man of please spare my lover and all other young boys like him. Let there be.
Men of War rocketed to number one, but not until 1965. Why Frisco held on to this timely and beautiful ballad for 3 years after it was recorded is anybody's guess, but Wanda Ruzanne, at least, got to record as a solo.
Well, hello there, so you're back again.
Long time no see.
And just where in the world have you been?
Did you
am I your true love? Or has a new love stolen your love from me? I've been so lonely, it's been a long time. No see.
Long time no see.
Tell me, dear, what do
Long time no see probably features Wanda's sisters on backup. But once they started college, the Roseanne sisters more or less gave up on show business. What's really strange about Frisco was that they recorded Danny White numerous times but were never able to get another hit with him. Finally, in 1964, Mrs. LaRocca's mentor, Harold Adkins, moved to Memphis to work at WDIA, the legendary local station, and he hooked Danny up with Isaac Hayes and David Porter, who were just beginning their songwriting career. Unfortunately, the results sound like it.
Sometimes I think about where I'd be if I didn't have you with me. My life wouldn't be the same, and I wouldn't have the power to love, 'cause I
Can't Do Nothing Without You wasn't Frisco's last record, but the local scene was falling apart. Cosmo Matassa was closing his studio, record labels were failing left and right, and Mrs. LaRocca folded Frisco in 1966. Listening to the stuff they recorded today, it's frustrating to think that at the very least, Kiss Tomorrow Goodbye has gone unheard, and that even with the best studio and musicians New Orleans had to offer, none of Frisco's productions ever got very far.
Our rock historian, Ed Ward, lives in Berlin. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer this week is Roberta Schirach. Our engineer today is Fred Snyder. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Sue Spolin directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
If you found a lover with a love so true, never tell your friend.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, by the state of Vermont, connecting summer travelers with the mountains, lakes, and historic villages of rural Vermont. Online travel planning at VermontVacation.com. And Bantam Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Fish, Blood, and Bone by Leslie Forbes, a tale of literary suspense. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Blood, an epic history of medicine and commerce. We talk with science journalist Douglas Starr. His book is the basis of a new PBS series on the story of blood. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.